Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about autonomous tractors. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at crop insurance changes for this next year. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the autonomous tractor. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. I know, guys. It's been one and done for the NFC North so far in the playoffs. If that, I don't know if that's a good or bad omen for the Lions this week, but
they're a better team than the other two, so
they got rest. So yep. they'll win one at least.
You think so?
Sure.
Because sometimes that rest is worse than
rest
anything.
Or rust, yeah. Kind of a thing. Yeah,
that's the Packers' bugaboo. Is that rest?
All right. I mean, arguably one of the strongest divisions as far as, like, record.
Well, we thought, but did they just beat up on each other? Packers got beat up by them and the Bears. But it was watching the Packers lose always hurts every time. But watching the Vikings lose after us was extremely therapeutic. Yep. Yes, thank you, Vikings fans.
It could have turned. That game could have turned, too, on that. Stafford flipped that got called.
Oh, that was
a
incomplete pass, fumble six. Yeah.
That was a terrible call.
Yeah, I saw him. I saw him flip it. But
so is that a fumble then? When you flip, he said he flicked.
He flicked it.
The flicker flip.
Yeah, it's probably should have been. It probably should have been a intentional grounding.
Right, that it wasn't anything.
Grass or just dead.
It was the running back, right? One of the running backs was in.
Was on near, Nakua,
supposedly. Yeah.
I thought it was Puka.
Puka Nakua was.
Or was it Puka? Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, his head wasn't even looking.
No. He was sad. Like, I just, that part of it was even, like, what is he even doing?
Right,
there?
The mental math on that of, like, why are you doing this? Like, stretching your arm out and even doing anything with the ball, you should be tucking it.
Yeah.
And just falling. But it is Matt Stafford, so.
Where do you guys stand on replay? Like, and is it, do you like it? Does it make you feel better? Like, enough of the replay stuff now. It's so close of a call anyway, and you get a feeling like that one. I'm like, oh, for sure is a fumble. Like, they ain't gonna.
And you get it wrong so many times. Like, right. Look at the Keyshawn Nixon
yes,
one.
Yes, that's where I was going with right. it. That like, was. Just
it's like, oh, that's easy. Nope, they're not going to change it. Like,
yeah, I don't know. It should just be all or nothing. They should either be, somebody should be looking at every play.
Yes.
Or right. They should be looking at nothing.
Right.
Because that was always the joke from the start of replay is like, well, we'll replay this, but not that. We can look at this, but not that. And now it seems they are adding more and more things to it, but it's still, because now they have the New York like override or whatever. They call it, but yeah, it
make you feel like the NFL has their finger on the league a little bit. Like they're not throwing games, they're not. But a few of these calls where they can, we're not going to change it.
It's a good story for the Rams to win because of what's going on over there, and they had to change stadiums. And
what's dumb to me is when they come back after the fact, like 3 days after the game's done, and be like. Yeah, we're going to fine somebody or we're going to do something for what happened in the game. Like, it wasn't
a penalty in the game.
We're going to punish the refs for the no call. Like, I thought that was the point of the New York thing was that somebody should be watching and, like, say, yep, nope, that should have been a call. Like, and you get out the big red phone, whatever, Batman style. Like, this is the commissioner. You're wrong. But they don't.
I bet every team could be like, well, replay helped us, but at the same time, it really didn't help us. So it's like,
I feel like in being a ref real time in the game, that'd make it, you'd think it'd make it easier, but in a way, now you got everybody like Monday morning quarterbacking you and telling you like, it'd be like if we were out making recommendations and then you had other people around us being like, that's a bad one, no, that ain't right, or what are you doing?
I was listening
You don't have that happen?
Yeah, I do.
Matt, we do it to Matt. So.
Yeah.
was listening to a radio station, and now in college basketball, they'll call goaltending on certain calls.
Oh, I've seen that. All some points are gone.
So that they can, like, if they don't call goaltending, they can't review it. So it's almost like a preemptive call so that they can go back and review it. And it's like, well, that's not the intent of how replay was supposed to be, or let's just
cheat
do some,
the system.
Yeah, like, let's do something almost fake to go back and fix it or make sure we did it right. And it's like, whatever.
I think they should make, like, a game show out of it. So just get, like, 100...
Pull down fans from each
like
side.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe, like, fans from all other teams, but then you maybe just do what's best for your team in
all,
a way, too.
All but the two teams that are...
But, yeah, they just show, like, 100 screens, and then people just vote in of what they think should happen, and then... That's what happens. That'd,
so we should merge American Idol. And
yes, correct. Ooh, we could have like a phone line. Yeah,
yeah.
But no Packer fans for a Packer game.
Well, right?
It has to be.
It would be hard to make that non-bias.
But a regional lockout's the best you could do like within a certain distance.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, no, I have no idea if this is a real statistic, but they always talk about it in like TV shows and stuff like. Eyewitness testimony is the most unreliable testimony there is because, you know, you think you're paying attention, but there's always details you can miss if you have. And video is supposed to kind of fix that. But, yeah, I mean, refs, who knows what they're actually seeing on the field? That's the one view we don't have.
There we
and
go.
Maybe we should
we need ref cam.
Strap GoPros on the ref to see exactly what they saw.
And then you can't be mad at them. Like, what are you looking at? Because you're like, oh, yeah, holy man, you didn't see any of that.
Right. Or as a linebacker's running them over, you'll just see the cleats and everything.
And that's the problem is it happens so fast that with replay now, we can go down to the millisecond and be like, oh, yep, he stepped out of bounds, he didn't, or he caught it and he didn't, or the ball moved in a certain way so minusculely that in real time you're never going to see that. And it's like, it's a catcher, it's not. Like, why do we have to minuscule it?
Yeah, it's almost one of the most annoying things about, and it's really certain color commentators do it the most. Chris Collinsworth. But, you know, when they're watching the super slow-mo replay and they're like, oh, yeah, look at that. It's obvious. This should have been, you know, whatever. It's like, well, yeah, but because it's slowed down and you've now watched it six times.
Frame by frame.
Right.
Yeah, the cameras to refs ratio is quite off. So in a normal regular season game, there's 12 to 20 cameras. And in the Super Bowl, there'll be 165 cameras.
Wow.
Wow.
And there is 7 refs plus one in charge of the replay review.
So do they bring all the cameras from all the stadiums?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't even know where you fit 160.
Oh, it's probably all the media. They probably can use all the media feeds or something at the Super Bowl. What I've never understood, completely anyway, is how one ref also can override the other refs. Like, how is that determined?
Yeah,
like
there must be a hierarchy.
Who's the boss?
Like, yeah.
Like, because sometimes the line judge will overrule, like, the back judge or whatever, and it's like, how is that determined by, like, type of play, angle?
I could, like, seniority? That happens in baseball, like, right? Like, one umpire will override a different one because of the way on the field they are and different angles and stuff, which, to me, that makes a lot of sense. I always get mad when the referee behind the play makes like an out call at a base. It's like, you were behind the play. How can you see through that guy? Whereas like if you have an umpire down the line.
But I mean, sometimes it's especially like when they're in the red zone or, you know, goal line plays, you have two refs running in from either side of the, like,
yeah,
they're the same position on either side of the goal line. And then one will do touchdown and one will do nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like, and they argue, and one of them ends up, you know, getting the call. It's like they were literally just across from each other, like, yeah. And maybe it is how the pile, you know, was formed and which side had a better view of the ball. But it just, yeah, I never have completely understood how that hierarchy works.
Well, all that rant, the Packers didn't lose because of the refs or the replay.
No, but it's... It always seems to be a factor somewhere in some game, whether it's ours or theirs, or, you know, who knows in the Super Bowl what crew they'll have yet, because that gets determined.
So do you change your fandom now to root for someone else, or are you just like, eh, whatever?
almost all the time I change my fandom, but this time I am more whatever, I guess. Because, that's a tough call because I do like the Buffalo Bills. Josh Allen's awesome. You know, like there's certain teams where you just, I feel like you can like a team from the other division. You know, that's okay.
Yep.
Like you're, so yes, like I don't know that I'd pick any NFC teams anymore. I more root for them to lose at this point than I would for any of them to win. But it's more of like the least hated team than it is that you like them. Do you have another?
More so just our in-house Lions fan, like wanting to see him happy. Like not so much, I don't, Lions, whatever, but that he has been suffering for 50,
forever,
57 years.
For all the time.
Other than that, I mean, I'm not a big, like, Patrick Mahomes, whatever. I don't, if they win again, fine. I don't, I'm so many people no, they've are won mad so many about times, him. Like,
yeah, right.
I don't care.
He's I just fine. Hope for a good game. Like, it sucks when it's a crappy Super Bowl where it's either really one-sided or it's too terrible, like, two teams that get so injured through the playoffs that, you know, neither one can do anything. Like,
I just wanted the Vikings to lose.
Yeah.
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 They just true. Feel so fraud, like. So well, I'm so glad they lost. That's all I cared about the rest of the way.
Yeah, the last like couple weeks, Sam Darnold looked like back in his Jets form when he was forced into a starter spot
right
after being drafted years ago.
Ghost again.
And we were listening to the Vikings announcer, you know, lament how much he's holding on to the ball, and it's like, yeah, how do you get that far in the season with that many wins? And just sit there and either not throw it away or even try to run, just feel like, nope, I guess I'll take the sack.
I was listening to another station last night, and they said that they've ran Aaron Jones way more than the Packers ever did.
Really?
Yeah. Like, he was getting 18 to 20 carries every game, and he would never get more than 12 or 13, 15, something like that. So I think their success was a lot around him because they were leaning on him more, but then they also said towards the end of the season he was breaking down more and not finishing games, and we're like, duh. Like,
right.
That's what he did for us, right?
Yeah.
He never could stay healthy, and now we got a running back that seems to want to get the ball more when it's crappier out.
Oh, that one run.
That was a cool run, yeah.
It was just a, like.
They did call that a touchdown, and then kind of like, no, he was a yard short.
Right.
Yeah, he was just bowling over guy. Right, that's what was cool too, is that they gave him back to him.
Just literally fighting his way through one-on-one, one-on-two at times. Like, yeah, I hope that continues into next season. Like, signs of a leader right there, I guess, as far as, like, I'm going to put my body on the line, I'm going to fight my way through and try to build momentum, and just never know. All right, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Mm-hmm.
So, last week, I was at the National No-Till Conference. Got to see some different stuff. It's a wide range of philosophies there. I mean, you get organic, you get regenerative, you get, predominantly no-till, but there are some strip-till
what
discussions there.
They can't be there.
Even though they have their
There's
own
There's no strippers allowed there, man. Did anybody say the M word or P word?
Yes, there was.
Somebody said it?
Some discussion of plow.
MP word?
The MP word, yes.
And it was, in fact, the M word plow.
Probably nutrient cycling.
It had to do with, stratification.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that could be a whole other episode. But my.
Do you feel at the no-till conference, is it getting more. When that first started, that was like. A very, like, you never tilled, and a very, like, that strong group that would go, if that makes sense. And is over the years, it get, like, watered down a little, or, like, is it still got that strong group? And maybe it always had that strong group, and it had some people that were learning about it and weren't no-tillers at the time.
It's a good, like I said, it's a good variety of opinions. You have those guys that are never till, you have... you know, the ones that are anti-chemical, you have the ones that are in the middle that are not tilling but using chemical and might, you know, fix stuff with tillage. So, I mean, in that way, it's good because other than one speaker this year, you know, you don't get a lot of, like, you know, guys getting up and walking out of rooms, or, you know, heckling or any of that kind of stuff. And there was just a little bit of that.
Just totally year, didn't agree with this. I'm out.
Right.
Then why do you come then if you're not going to have an open mind about what you're listening to?
And that's, I think, one of the things that normally makes it a good conference is you get lots of different perspectives.
Right, right. I could see that being...
Rather than if ever there was no, like, never till and stuff and anti-chemical and, you know, if everything was always super opinionated, then you'd have such a limited audience that, you know, probably wouldn't work as well as it does, because I know they said they had like 600 some registrants, but I think it was probably a little less than that. It was actually at the conference. I didn't count tables or anything like that, but it was well attended, though, for the most part. But for me, what was one of the really interesting speakers was actually a guy from Germany who came and talked. And he was, or is, not was, is, the founder of Horsch Manufacturing. Michael Horsch was there talking about kind of what they do in Europe. So he grew up on a farm in Germany. And he talked about a wide variety of things, but what I thought was really interesting was kind of at the tail end of his talk, he talked about autonomy. So all the work he was kind of showing of these development projects they had for autonomous planters and drills and all that kind of stuff. And he kind of bucked the way we think of autonomy versus how it actually has been incorporated. And we've talked about this a little bit in previous episodes, but...
I love talking about autonomy because it's polarizing. Guys like driving tractors.
Right.
And so...
To the core.
Oh, yes. Like, and not all farmers, but in... Okay. All farmers do enjoy driving tractors, but some just like driving tractors.
Yep.
And some like the other, you know.
Some are cow guys.
Right, doing things on the computer or in the barn or other things. But I think even like the cow guys, if you want to call it that, or computer guys, they still like driving the tractor.
Right.
Like, that's still fun. That's still part of the farming, you know, experience and all that. Even the fact of, like, kids today playing Farm Simulator. Like,
yep.
Most of Farm Simulator, when you watch it, is driving the tractor part and seeing what that is, and the graphics have gotten good enough where it's cool. So I just think it's cool because even going back, and this goes back to one of our early episodes where we talked about back in the day when tractors first, like, were invented, I guess you'd call it. And at that time we were all using horses and basically horses. And at that time there was articles that literally said, we're never going to switch to tractors because we like horses so much. And then over 50 years,
we're horse people.
Yes, like we.
How can we have a farm without a horse?
Without a horse,
yeah,
we don't want
tractor
this.
Is evil, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want this smelly, you know, gasoline oil tractor and all the bad stuff. And then over, it was like a 40 to 50 year span. You know, horses very slow decline, and tractors kind of a very slow incline. So autonomy and autonomous tractors, I think, is going to be a similar curve that we're at. You're 10 or 20 of 50 years on this curve. So how that goes is going to be really interesting. Like, we're right at that maybe tipping point here in the next 10 years of, like you say, how it actually happens is going to be decided by us, which is really cool.
Yeah. And it makes sense. It's going that way, right? Farms are getting larger. Workforce is getting harder to come by. Like, we're at this apex of somehow we got to fix this labor thing. And obviously this could be one of those reasons, ways to do that.
What is odd about it, when AI or this kind of technology, I always thought it would take away, like, mundane tasks first, and not, like, in AI, it's taking over some of the creative tasks, which I didn't think, you know, writing songs and drawing things. And even in this case, I thought, well, okay, it would take over, which it has. There's some, you know, robotic milking. And I'm not saying, you know, milking cows, it's great one time a day. It's when you get to have to do it twice, it gets harder. But guys love, you know, your reason you milk cows is because you like it. So even driving tractor, the reason you do it is because you like it. So some of the times that it's taking over tasks that we enjoy, I didn't always see that coming. I thought it would take over more meaningless or menial tasks.
The stuff nobody wanted to do.
Right, right. Yeah. Not things that we still like doing. Yeah. But
we need to do paperwork.
Right. That would be great.
Just do our paperwork for us. So, yeah, Michael Horsch started his company from scratch. So, like I said, farming in Germany. They were no-tillers. That's why he was at the no-till conference. Used his family farm to develop equipment. They had a hard time finding, you know, good no-till equipment, so they were kind of building their own stuff. He talked about how, you know, he started out, like, nobody kind of wanted his stuff, but his family supported him, and he was able to keep going, and now they're a global company. They have manufacturing in most in Germany, but also a factory in Brazil. They go all over the world selling equipment. They're moving into North America now. You can get some of their equipment in certain parts of the U.S. I think they were based out of North Carolina.
North Dakota, it looks like. It's just his Horsch. Yeah, 200 Knutson Street in Mapleton, North Dakota.
Okay. I know they have a southern plant, too, because the conference was in Kentucky, and there were guys. I saw a couple Horsch trucks from North Carolina, so I thought maybe that was where. But it might have just been the local dealer. But anyway, so, you know, this isn't some guy who doesn't know equipment. He himself did a lot of the early development, still kind of has a hand in equipment development. So he's not, you know, it's not some engineer who thinks they can do better. This guy built a company on his ideas. So seems to be a pretty decent source of information. And he spent years developing autonomous planters and stuff. And so he showed us a video of a couple of the planters they had, and he's like, yep, you know, they work great, except they don't. And he said, it's not that it doesn't do the job. He said the biggest thing they ran into, and the reason they're putting cabs back on these designs,
cabs, let's go,
is because every time the operator left the field, something happened. Started dragging old corn stalks. Yep. Started doing something.
That's like the trouble. What happens when something goes wrong?
Right. So he said it's better to have a cab and just have an operator in there. I don't care if he's sleeping, but when the alarm goes off,
he could be playing Farm Simulator in the cab while he's simulating his.
He can get out of the cab, fix the problem, and get the machine back up and running quickly. And I say that because, you know, not that everyone's gone cabless yet, but that's always kind of been that concept. You know, when you see people dreaming of the autonomous tractor, it's out there, it's doing its own thing, driving through the field, and you're at home drinking your coffee. Like, I think,
like watching them on a computer. Usually,
I remember if it was John Deere who had like a commercial for maybe an operations center or something like that where, you're just sitting on your phone, drinking your coffee, managing your farm from the kitchen table.
I saw a piece of advertisement on, like, in the mail or, like, on a website of that exact thing where it was like, oh, you see the tractor, the planter out and the sprayer's out and you see the satellite in the air and the fake, you know, like, trajectory from the satellite to the planter, and then the guy's just sitting in his kitchen table watching it all happen.
Which
the future of farming,
maybe, you know, we'll get there someday, but like we just said, guys like driving tractors,
right?
So we also would like sitting in a tractor and letting it drive, especially if you're fatigued. That'd be great. And then like making sure it's running properly, you still have to do that, and you don't want your tractor to be like, if it figures out something's wrong, parked and send you a text. Now you got to run out there, fix it, and there's downtime that could be avoided if you're just there.
Right.
So that does make a lot of sense. That's interesting.
20 years ago, farmers were saying how much less fatigued they were at the end of the day just with auto steer.
Yes.
Like taking the auto steering and having to like focus on that point at the end of the field or focus on the marker, take that away, how much less fatigued they are. Now, I think you're right, Matt, like in the sense of like what happens if a corn stalk or you hit a stone or a bearing goes out, like some of that stuff that you have to have a sensor that's going to recognize what's going on to alert the person. Whereas if you get to the end of the road and you go, oh, that road doesn't look right, and you jump out, and it's like, oh, there's a stone caught in the closing wheels or something of that nature, which happens on every farm every year, right?
Right. Like, and so, yeah, the idea of, you know, sitting at your kitchen table while all of a sudden the planter's, you know, 440s away has air and has to stop. Yeah, how much time is it going to take you to get to it, fix it? By the time you get back home, maybe it hit another one or, you know, something else happened. It just, it's a lack of efficiency.
It's the same with the robot, the milking robots, right? Someone still has to be available.
Right. It sends them a text. And like I said, that you can maybe have a little, afford a little downtime to get there and fix it.
But someone still at 4 a.m. when that robot's not working has to go be available.
And yeah, it's not, the way to think of it is not like free labor. Like I'm totally, don't have to touch it, you know, set it, forget it, easy button type stuff. It's that it's different labor distribution. You still have to manage it, but you're managing in a different way. And so his take, he didn't specifically say this, but this is kind of the way I thought of it. It was rather than being at your kitchen table, you're working from the cab of that piece of equipment, doing other whatever else you can do from there.
That's true multitasking right there.
Like, that's your desk is riding the planter in planting season. And so, yeah, you can be making phone calls because the machine will run. And it's like, oh, hang on, I got to go do this or whatever, reset this. And then you're right back to work, and it's more efficient. The other thing that he said that's kind of been bucking a current trend, and even some stuff I saw a year or two ago at the No-Till conference, was the idea that smaller is better, like having several small machines doing the work. Instead of the 24-row planter, you've got 3 8-row planters or whatever, so that you're managing multiple fields at a time, and then that's what's going to save you the time. But think about what we just talked about. If we've got three 8-row planters running, and they all start getting errors, problems, and now you got to run between 3 different fields to fix 3 different planters, did you gain anything?
It's 3 times the chance of something to go wrong.
Right. And chances are, Murphy's Law, they're all going to have it at the same,
same time.
Or at least 2 of them. You know, maybe one will run fine, but the other 2. So his big thing, along with the putting a cab back on the autonomous stuff, was smaller is not better. Might as well be efficient, get as much done as you can. And keep it bigger. Which is, again, like I said, kind of bucking that trend of what we think of when it comes to some of this stuff, you know, the weed robots, even the little laser zapping weed robot that's running up and down your field, the way they talk about those, like that they'd be small to start with, is that really gaining you an efficiency? Because one of those tips over, takes out 4 corn plants, and then you got to go ride it, fix it.
Well, it would be hard, this swarm idea where you have multiple ones and then you have one person watching over them and having to like fix them. I agree with you in some ways, Matt. The Harper is all that guy's going to be doing all day is like fixing these things. You know, like if you got 20 going,
now there's a good chance
many of them are broken and you're just over there like, oh, okay, this thing did this again. And
this hose broke.
So that is interesting idea that certain things could get smaller, but at the same time, do we need to make them smaller when you could?
And the fight we fight now is the bigger equipment, like a hose breaks or something, a hydraulic hose or whatever. Like if you got a 24-row planter, that's a big thing to be down.
Right, the whole planter.
Right,
down.
If you had like three 8-rows, like at least
you still got 16 something rows going. Yeah,
right.
That's going to always be a problem, though. Like whether it's autonomous or not.
What is interesting? This is coming from somebody from Europe. And in general, Europe versus United States, they have kind of smaller equipment in general.
Nope. And that was my... So, actually, you're jumping my next point.
Sorry, man.
Nope, that's
fine.
Keep
going.
Because that was what I found interesting, too, is this idea of, like, this guy is Germany. When you think about tractors, like, I had the opportunity to go to Waterloo and see, like, the John Deere plant. And they had the European tractors with the smaller tires, like, skinny tires, more compact. It's a
different line.
Right. It's a whole different line compared to the ones we have here in the U.S., So, yeah, to hear a European manufacturer say bigger is better, and granted, he, you know, on the global scale, like especially places like Brazil, makes total sense in Brazil because they're, you know, they're not farming fence lines. They're farming, you know.
Sections.
So, you know, maybe it doesn't all pertain right back to his home farm, but, yeah, it's an interesting concept to see that kind of different way of thinking and a different, you know, just perspective from a place that really operates a lot differently. Even, you know, you talked about cropping rotations and different stuff there and how much different it is and actually how much harder no-till can be in their environment. Because, and I don't know a ton about European farming, you know, NAICC, we hear stuff once in a while, and it, you guys maybe have been going longer and heard more, but I guess it's nothing for wheat to be like 10, 11 months of a crop in some places there. And the residue is, you know, they're growing high yielding wheat.
Right. Yeah.
And like the residue is
50 bushel wheat. Yeah.
Way harder to manage.
Sure.
Even in wheat than it is here. And they're not doing the same, you know, corn, soybean, wheat rotation we're doing because of the climate and everything. But so just the way they design equipment can be very different. So
did he give you a, like, here's my thoughts on the trajectory of implementation of some of this stuff? I mean, that's hard to know, right?
But right. No, I think he and his vision of autonomy was that there was going to be a place for it. But, you know, much like we've been talking about robot milking, obviously it took a few years for it to really get to the point where guys were like, yep, this is worth it. You know, there's trial and error because really they've been around for, you know, robot milkers have been around for a long time at this point, probably, you know, what, late 90s, early 2000s. So 30, almost 30 years of that. And within the last probably 3-4 years, it's really become more.
What is interesting when you use this as a, using the story of robot milking to tractors is even in the robot milking, one of the big technologies thought was the robot.
Right.
However, what's also changed in the last 10 years, a lot of advancement is in the barn and animal layout setup.
Yep.
So that was interesting, too, that it wasn't like we needed the robot technology, but then you also needed the, like, cow flow and how to move, you know, how to have cattle move around in an area so that they will flow to this milking machine. So using that in the tractor world is, we don't know what, like, one of the things I thought is we would actually get away from sort of needing that power implement, like a tractor.
Sure.
And then having the tool behind it. We'd almost go to, like, a combine, essentially, for most of our tools would be combined with that power unit. However, as you look more, the cost of that, now everything has a power unit, so everything is an engine, you know, everything, like, so that gets harder to do. So you still kind of do want this sort of power unit. And then the other thing is these cabless tractors, what do you do with them on the road? Like, you still have to move this on a road from field A to B. And right now, I don't know how that technology exactly works, but you'd still need somebody in there to drive it at that point. So, like you say, to estimate where we're going to be in 20 years would be hard, but it is interesting to see that some of these ideas of the cabless tractor is just going to go away, like, for now. Maybe it'll come back, or maybe there'll be the swarm idea where you have one cab tractor and two cabless tractors with you, but for now I could see why that would go to the wayside.
Yeah, or you develop a maintenance robot that stays with
you
and is able to manage those issues. That's kind of like what you were alluding to before, is we're fixing problems that in a way that we didn't think we were going to be doing. It's the tasks that almost need to be done by humans that still need to be done by humans.
Right.
And some of the other stuff that maybe we didn't think would be automated is being automated.
One other thing I think is that, you know, as they're marketing these and what does their customers want, most, say, especially in the crop side and farming, you have days in the, you know, in the shop, you know, 200 to 300 days a year, and in the office that many days, and you got, I don't know, 60 to 90 days sort of in the field. So for them to give that up and say, and again, there'd be people that are going to do this. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. However, for them to give that part of up of their job where I'm going to just sit in an office still and watch all my tractors run, like, why would you even want that? Like, they're going to, you know, they'd rather be out in sort of a mobile office in some way, whether it's in your cab of your truck outfitted where you're watching them, you know, from the edge of the field and then fixing or whatever. But I just, when they're marketing these, they also got to look at that and go, like, even the way the cabless tractors look, it's goofy. They're goofy looking. You know, they, like, they're not what we're used to because they don't have that sort of centralized, you know, area to watch from and that kind of thing. So
what are the things, like, so you did have some self-propelled units. You did have some, you know, that were still pulled by tractors. But I think one of the interesting things with how this works is the accumulation of technology providing an overall improvement of the end product. So in his discussions about equipment and everything else, he also touched on the idea of just look at the how much better you're doing without a marker. So the planting, you know, if your planter row gets in where the marker is, that's never your best corn.
Right.
And wheels, he also talked about where, you know, wheel placement, trying to keep wheels offset from rows so that you're not running over the rows with the tires or putting them at least offset to the tire so that it's not dead center on the tire where there's the most weight pushing down on it. So it's really not just about the autonomy, but it's about taking the technologies that exist and what we have and improving the quality of the job that the machine is doing. And if it makes sense to automate things as it plays. So I thought that was kind of a cool philosophy too, from his perspective of, we're not just trying to make something that you don't have to run. We want it to do a good job first. And if we could make it less work for you, that's kind of the cherry on top. Rather than the other way of like, nope, we don't have the guy. I need something to do this. I don't care how good of a job it does. I just need something, and you know, we'll figure it out. So I thought that was a good philosophy. So after that, I looked at you know, some of the major companies, New Holland, Case, John Deere, Fendt tractors, just to kind of see where they stood in their autonomous efforts with cabs. And really, so far, most of them are still keeping the cab. Case was probably about the only one that had the design without it.
Correct. Case is that one we've talked about it too. It was at one of the big farm shows. They really, you know, and kind of had that cabless tractor look. So that is interesting that I can't think of any other ones that sort of release that. And then, but what you're saying is Case has both. They have like cab and no cab.
Yep. So if you look, I got a link there if you guys want to look at it, but basically their autonomous is through like a phased approach. So they have different categories, different phases that would go through. And so, you know, first is guidance. That's the one that we touched on that almost everybody has the capability of doing some sort of guidance, whether it's just a light bar to, you know, auto steer, that kind of stuff being, you know, the second phase. Then is coordination and optimization. So being able to link then to guided vehicles so that maybe when you come up to the combine,
and that's being done already,
right, that you don't have to, you know, it match the tractor it. Will kind of know where to go. You're still driving to the combine, but then
it's matching the speed of the combine with right. the grain cart, and it knows how full the grain cart is. It can move it up or down to get different spots of the grain cart.
So it's like your docking procedures. Yeah. In all the sci-fi movies. Then you have operator assisted autonomy, supervised autonomy, where, and that's kind of what we're talking about with the horse stuff, is you still need somebody there. You're not, you know, supervised autonomy, I think is a good way to put it. And then full autonomy where, and I like the little picture of a phone and a guy pushing a button, you know, so that's what we talked about at the beginning, like, you know, this dream of, yep, get up in the morning, stretch, sit down, eat your cereal, oatmeal, whatever, and push the button so that planting starts in field, whatever, and then your tender is driving to that planter and you start that tractor up, and, you know, keyless, kind of like what we have on cars where, you know, remote start, keyless entry, all that kind of fun stuff, but not having to actually physically drive it. So I think that, you know, their layout makes sense, and they had the most probably detailed, at least what I could find on their website, you know, path of...
That is neat. Those categories are interesting because that does make sense that we think of this as being like this category five.
Right.
And there's steps along the way before you get
there. We're going to go 1 to 100 and right away.
Right.
And I think, too, one of the things is it's a lot of these new startups that are like... almost kind of overshooting the mark of like, yep, no cab, small, like let's get into this space, figure something out, and maybe don't have the full understanding of, you know, years of technology development like these major companies have. Not to say that those are bad and that they can't work, but, you know, they're trying to find their niche in the market that makes them different, makes them stand out, gets the attention versus, you know, these other ones have probably been working on these for the better part of the last 30, 40 years, or maybe even longer, to kind of see where they can go. And I would say just from a standpoint of, you know, publicity and all that kind of stuff, the John Deere stuff is probably maybe a little bit on the leading edge. I think Case is right there because, like we said, they released that cabless tractor design at one of the shows and had things. But, you know, New Holland and Fendt do have autonomous aspects there, but I don't think it's as widely known. You know what I'm saying? That like as popularized as the, you know, the red versus green stuff that we see out there. So there's a lot of it out there. It really is.
What do you guys think? As I look at the pictures of these, I see like one big problem, and that is if people are driving by and see nobody in a cab and it driving,
right?
Like there's going to be like red flag, like, yeah, there's going to stop and think something's wrong, you know, like. Like, so, like, is it going to be, what's the solution? Like, mannequins in there?
The like, cabless is almost better from that standpoint because it's like, oh, well, it's doing its own thing versus you're right. Like
this, you drive up, you see an empty seat, like, what the guy, heck? You know,
did the like, person have, on the floor because they had a heart attack? Right. Or,
yeah, you're probably going to have to, like put a sign at the end of the field or
put
something.
Some sort that of says, lighting, like a something that's a, you know, driver, like, that you would know that this is a driverless tractor, that's okay.
We're just going to put cardboard cutouts. of whatever.
Get the ones from Tech Days that directed traffic.
Oh, yeah, the silhouettes. Yeah.
That worked so good.
Yep, that'll solve it right there. Done.
Yeah, at some point it'll probably just be like a projector that'll project a person on the window or something so it looks like somebody's driving. See that?
Actually, it'd be cool, like black out the cab. You know, just
tint
take
windows.
It to your buddy that tints windows and just get her like really tinted and nobody will even know. And then you can really play tricks on people.
The future on-farm babysitter. You just put your kid in the tractor. Like, yep, just sit on the seat. Don't touch anything.
That sounds perfect. What could go wrong there?
Don't touch anything. But then have the ability to like lock out the controls where they can't, even if they do touch anything, that doesn't do anything. But yeah, so I thought that was an interesting take. It's kind of I don't want to call it a step backwards because I don't think it's a step backwards. I think it's more of just a realization of, you know, cabless was almost trying to jump too far ahead right now. You got to throttle it back, get back to basics, make sure you have the abilities. Because then, too, like you not only, you know, transport from field to field, but from a maintenance standpoint, where is your access to a lot of the controls? You know, how do you know what's not working if you don't have a screen somewhere? If you don't, you know, you could have a light panel somewhere built into the machine, but
but
that's always been the command center.
It still has, well, a good thing is people do more with robotics and creating robots. A lot of them are either, you know, human like or dog like, or they have some sort of persona. The more they saw this, like, you need something to have like a seeing mechanism like a human would with their, you know, eyes. They have other sensors. And then obviously like you say in a tractor, like that cab was also where, like you said, the computers were and the central things were. So to pull that away, you'd still have to have access somehow to it in a spot. Well, why not keep the cab then?
Right.
I don't know what it'd be interesting to know what like the cab adds for extra cost to a tractor, because I'm sure it's enough that if you'd eliminate it, you'd eliminate some costs. But at the same time, you'd still have to have some sort of central area, like you say, Matt, to be able to access those kind of things.
And it, you know, I've seen the joystick where there's like a door and the joystick kind of pops up and you can.
Well, I think of like manure boats, you know, those, the guys just operating from a. And those, I think most of them that I've seen, you could still get on them and access certain things. You know, there's, I don't know that, I think you still use the joystick if you're on top of it, but yeah.
But how much have we gone away from open station tractors for a reason? You know,
like, right.
If you're,
right.
If you're going to be operating the equipment, you need the windshield to keep, you know, protect you from the dust, the rain, whatever.
Right.
Like, if it's pouring rain and you got to move the thing and all you got is a joystick and you're standing on it, nobody's going to want to be doing that job either.
Let's be like, even a lot of maintenance is just like listening to the machine and watching it. So you're right, Matt. So so where are you going to go to even do that if you have a cabless tractor? So that is a good point. Like, you'd still need some sort of jumper seat somewhere. Well, you're not going to want it, you know, on the fender and or like riding the hitch like you used to.
What?
Yeah. So, yes, you're right about that.
Even the idea, like, I mean, and this may seem out of left field a little bit, but I like the backup cameras on trucks, especially for backing up to hitches and that kind of stuff. But I don't know about you guys, how many times you got to go take your finger and wipe that little camera lens off?
Oh, yes.
So that
especially you actually see winter, yes.
Right. So the idea of even like no cab, but having a spot where you could get inside and maybe watch on a camera, I think of that and I'm like, well, yeah, but what's going to clean the camera lens off?
Yeah, yeah, right.
You're not going to be able to see, or it's going to be hazy. And
yeah, you're right.
Well, so. And Case IH has got actually like an eight-minute video. I'm just rolling through here, and like the weather is perfect. It's in it's in no-till into wheat ground, and like their whole marketing is like the conditions are perfect. So it's like, you're right, Matt. Like cameras are great, but and even the sensing stuff is great. But then in my pickup, when like the front sensors, as soon as I get any snow or ice on it, they don't work, and I can't even set my cruise.
Right.
What's wild? Think of how annoying that's going to get when you got to fix all that stuff, the sensing stuff. You're just gonna be like, well, I'd rather just ride on it and be the sensor. And even our 2019 Ford, what just went out on it was the whole big screen, you know. And when that goes, like all that technology is going to fail at some point too, and then you're at that. So the obviously, you want a lot of technology in the machine, but if you don't have to put all these redundancies in there that will also fail, that would be nice too.
Yeah, it's almost like we're solving one problem but creating a new set of problems.
Right. I've got some. So the driverless tractor is kind of a name, and we'll usually call it like tractor operator or tractor driver. And I think operator maybe still fits, even if you're not driving it, you're kind of still watching it. But I've got some names for you guys for what we'd call these people and see what you think. So you're basically like, there's tractor sentinel, there's tractor sentry, tractor watcher, tractor onlooker. We could go with tractor viewer, observer, any of the, like, none of these names are cool. That's the problem I'm having. Like, there's not, like, even driverless is lame to me. Like, it sounds like, well, you're not important anymore. You're driverless. So yes, like I think sentinel would be cool maybe, because you're just kind of like standing guard over it. You're maybe a tractor guard. You're kind of just watching over.
Isn't that what protects the wheel?
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. You know, I guess the way I look at it is you're more of a mechanic at that point, because you're there to fix the issues.
Right, so you're not operating it anymore.
Right, you're just, not really
you're
the operator.
Like fixer guy. Yeah,
right.
True.
You're the IT guy for the tractor. But it's a combination of like, and I think that's because that's the other thing with tractors. A lot of guys like to try to do work themselves on tractors, or have an in-house mechanic to do a lot of the work. And I'm not saying it's not true now, because it is, but you almost have to like be very computer literate and very mechanically literate to work on these things, and that's only going to increase. You know, there's still always going to have to be some mechanical aspect to it, but the computer side is going to get way more complicated. Yeah. as well, we move into this.
I got it for you. Tractor technician.
Yep, there you go.
That's TT. It. Yep. You're just out
hiring
there,
for a TT.
You're just like, because you're right, Matt. There's it's mechanic. It's all of that. So yes, you're there to keep things going.
Yep. All right. So there you go. There's a look at kind of the state of autonomy, and like I said, I don't think we're moving backwards, but I think we're realizing we got to walk before we can run with some of this stuff, and that even the things that we maybe don't attribute as much value to, we've realized that there's more value than we expected. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So there are some changes coming to the federal crop insurance that may present opportunities for farmers. Crop insurance specialist with Farm Credit Illinois said changes to the federal crop insurance program will offer opportunities. Jack Young says farmers can protect even more of their crop in 2025 with improvements to the Enhanced Coverage Option, or ECO. Subsidies actually increased a bit on Enhanced Coverage Option. He says that is going to net result a lower cost to the producer to go to the 90% or 95% coverage level. It could be a potential game changer for a lot of producers. Said the federal program, rest of the program remains unchanged, but there are normal programs, revenue protection, yield protection, area protection are all functioning same as in the past. So the eco option, if you're not doing that now, might be worth a second look just in case it would make sense to you. Crop insurance decisions be made this spring. So good thing to maybe get ahead of and talk to your crop insurance agent to see if these changes would benefit you. All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we're talking about autonomous tractors, when did the quest for the autonomous tractor really begin? Well, it's been around for a long time. Fall of 2016 was when Case IH and New Holland both introduced driverless tractors at the Farm Progress Show in Boone, Iowa, and at Husker Days in Grand Island, Nebraska. Much talk and fanfare about the arrival of these concept vehicles and the implications of their development in the ag industry. 6 years later, even more manufacturers like John Deere, Fendt, and Autonomous Tractor Corps joined this group of manufacturers looking for autonomy. But did you ever think that maybe new farming technologies like this was coming from a long time ago? The concept has been there since the early part of the 19th century. So inventing and farming in Dawes County from the 1920s to the 1960s, they may not have had a good look at what this was going to look like, but they did have thoughts about concepts. In 1940, Frank W. Andrew invented a driverless tractor system that was comprised of a barrel or fixed wheel in the center of the field, and it would wind a cable that was attached to the steering arm of the front of the tractor. 2 decades before Andrew came up with this design, a 20-year-old Nebraskan, whose father owned a blacksmith shop, developed and patented an automatic tractor guide that would lead a steel-wheeled tractor in a concentric circles around the field. So kind of like how we run center pivots. So that inventor was Frank Zybach, man known today as the father of the center pivot. Said that Zybach came up with the idea of hands-off tractor driving while he was plowing a field. As he prepared to plant his crop, it occurred to him that plants grew just as well in crooked rows as straight ones. He decided to plow his field in circles. So like Andrew, Zybach began in the middle of the field and plowed a tight spiral, and then got in the front wheel of the tractor down in the furrow and let go of the steering wheel. Tractor would continue plowing in circles in larger and larger spirals until it ran out of fuel. That's awesome. Or when the wheel came out of the furrow. That's why he patented the automatic tractor guide wheel to keep the wheel of the tractor going in concentric circles around the field. So, yeah, when you look at center pivots, that was actually kind of the start of autonomous tractors.
Would you get dizzy? Like, dude, that's awesome.
I feel like,
that is like plowing. Like,
you'd start dizzy because you were going faster.
The bigger circle.
The bigger circle would be fine.
And I don't know, at the risk of having someone yell at me all these years later, I don't know if you guys ever did this, but did you ever try, like, really just above idling, like, the tractor running, and then, like, I would do this picking stones.
Oh,
like jump off the tractor, go throw a couple stones on, and then jump back onto the tractor because it was going slow enough.
Right.
Did you guys ever do that or not?
No.
No? All right. Guess I was the daredevil.
I think we got yelled at so bad if we got caught. No, but nah, not that.
And it wasn't.
Like you say,
usually wasn't like that there was a lot of rocks that had to get picked up, but just one of those things where it was like, oh, it's. Seems kind of cool. Let's see how long the tractor will go in a straight line before it starts going one way or the other. And like I said, it wasn't going very fast. And yeah, there was probably the risk of getting run over, but I'd usually come from the back.
Would you go in the back? Yeah.
Not in front of the tire, but yeah, I think it's that kind of thinking, though, that...
Well, mobile plow was the first, like, auto steer. You just kind of...
Pop her in the furrow.
The furrow and let her rip. I mean, you still kind of... You can... Let go, but in general, it was,
Yeah, you weren't steering hard.
No.
And if you tried to make a tight turn, that would have probably ended very badly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just kind of an interesting way to think about it.
All right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. We need you to tell as many guys as you can. We need, more. All we ask you to do is get out there and ask more people to listen. So it's really easy. You just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts or on your Android phone. You need to download an app like Podcast Addict, and there you can put all your favorite podcasts on it. And you can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. It's very easy. Just go to tilthegg.com/podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. It's time for our Cool Beans. That's corny. It's a current event. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, nitrogen optimization program already helping farmers potentially plan for 2025. So the state of Wisconsin is backing a nitrogen optimization pilot program, and some of the early research is helping farmers plan for this next season. Matt Ruark with the University of Wisconsin said field experiments will continue as the second year of some of these studies begin. He tells Brownfield the team working with farms around the state to test optimum nitrogen rate relative to other practices like manure use, cover crops, and tillage is going on. So what we have coming in this is great data set that evaluates how much nitrogen do you need, what's the variation in your nitrogen need as you move through your field. Said farmers running their own test plots should use different higher and lower rates. You really need the low rates, maybe even a zero, to figure out what the real value you're getting, how much yield increase you're getting when you put out more nitrogen, and it really helps you dial in how much money am I making with these fertilizer inputs. So I know I've worked a little bit with some of these programs, and Bill and I are looking at potentially another one this year, and I think everybody should at one time, and it's a hard thing to do because you're like, I don't want to do zero. But doing a zero rate really will show you a lot about what's going on in a given year with your field. And
doesn't have to be big.
No.
don't have to make a big area of zero, but a zero area does help.
Even when you go back to like the Green Seeker days when you had to have that to really use that sensor.
Low end, high end. Remember we did those PSNT studies where we went to that one spot a bunch of times?
Yep.
And there too, I think those had less nitrogen. So yeah, I would agree with you, Matt, on that. Is like it just helps you see what's out there. And in general now with the equipment we have, there's no skips on anything, herbicide or this planter to kind of show you that. So it's a little different.
All right. That's corny this week. When will over-the-top dicamba be available again for soybean growers? Well, it looks to remain off-label for 2025, and that could stretch into 2026. So the future of over-the-top dicamba products and soybeans is unclear. labels for those products, such as Extendamax, Ingenia, and Tavium, were vacated for the second time by an Arizona federal court in February of 2024. Existing stock order was put in place, which allowed limited use in 2024. And as of right now, there are no labels approved for the use of OTT dicamba on dicamba-resistant soybeans for 2025, according to Tommy Butts, the best name in weed science at Purdue University. There's no label pre or post, just no longer exists as an option. New labels were submitted to the EPA by Bayer, Syngenta, and BASF in 2024, but they include substantial changes. If EPA approves them, Extendamax would be a pre-emergence only application, and Ingenia and Tavium would have a V2 cutoff. So, just not something that you should be planning on anytime soon yet, which is unfortunate, because when used properly, I think the technology, you know, had its place, but just it's getting harder and harder to do, so... Now we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. This week we're going to talk about the newest Wisconsin Fairs of the Fair. Megan Salentine from Kewaunee County was selected as from a group of 33 county and district Fairs of the Fairs to serve as ambassador for the Wisconsin Association of Fairs. Salentine is the daughter of Jenny and Josh Salentine of Luxembourg and is a student at St. Norbert College. The Wisconsin Fairs of the Fair travels extensively through the state, promoting the educational, agricultural, social, cultural, and commercial benefits and opportunities available at Wisconsin's fairs. Salentine will serve a one-year term and succeeds Kelsey Henderson of Racine County. So it is kind of cool. We've got Allison Dairyland, Fairs of the Fairs, a lot of outreach available for ag in Wisconsin. So congratulations to Megan. That'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
This week, we talked about autonomous tractors. In our spotlight, we took a look at how crop insurance changes might present opportunities. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of autonomous tractors. Cool Beans this week was the NOPP program helping farmers possibly prepare for 2025. That's Corny was over-the-top dicamba still not available after the vacation of those registrations. And our Field Good Friday was Megan Salentine named Wisconsin Fairs of the Fairs for this year. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.